While most of coastal America were wringing their hands about the ascendancy of Donald Trump to the office of president and what it meant about the state of right-wing backlash politics in America, our next guest was starting what he calls the insurgency beat. As editor-at-large for The Nation magazine, D.D. Guttenplan has been touring the country, drilling down with the organizers, the visionaries, the people who think he thinks might be the basis for a new resurgent left-wing politics in this country. The ultimate work product is his new book, The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority, which he'll be presenting tonight at a KPFA talk at 7:30 p.m. at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley. Don Guttenplan, thank you so much for coming in.
Great to be here, Ron.
So as you described it to me just moments ago before we went on the air, you really never stopped your campaign pace of coverage, touring the country, profiling people who are trying to make change. What was the most inspiring thing you've come across in the last 2 years?
Well, I've come across lots of inspiring things. I suppose the most inspiring thing are people who never stop fighting. So the first chapter in my book is about a woman called Jane McAlevey, who's a union organizer and who is in fact based not far from here. And her work goes on regardless of who's in the White House. But the interesting thing is that it's the first chapter in the book, and it's called How to Win Under Conditions of Extreme Adversity, because we are under conditions of extreme adversity. My book has been described as an optimistic book, a hopeful book, and I'm willing to take the rap for both of those charges. But it also says pretty early on that my mantra, particularly after the election in 2016, became no more wishful thinking. So I'm trying to look very hard at things that work in our current climate. And the labor organizing that Jane's doing works in our current climate. Some of the efforts to move the Democratic Party away from its addiction to corporate money. So I write about Jane Kleb, who was a Bernie Sanders organizer and one of the key people in stopping the Keystone Pipeline. She's now the head of the Democratic Party in Nebraska. And so that whole state party has moved to wean itself from corporate money and from the positions that relying on corporate money imply. There are also, you know, there are people who are doing activism for racial justice, who I write about, Chukwuemeka Antar-Lumumba, who's the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. So there's a lot of inspiring stuff going on. But I guess the part for me that I found most inspiring was the realization on the part of lots of people. Two things. One, that there are many more of us than we were supposed to be. In other words, the left has been marginalized and been told that we're marginal by the media in America for decades. You know, you remember Ronald Reagan and Lee Atwater worked very hard to make liberal a dirty word. And for those of us who've always been to the left of liberal, you know, where does that leave us? Since the fall of the Berlin Wall, they don't call us communists anymore. But to call yourself a socialist, as Bernie Sanders did, was an invitation to derision. And yet, I would go to Sanders rallies around the country and I'd look around and the most amazing thing to me was how many of us there were. You know, and if you look at the vote totals, there are literally millions of us. And if you look at the polls and you say to people, well, do you think that having health care coverage that isn't rationed by wealth is a good idea? You know, the vast majority of Americans agree with that. The vast majority of Americans agree that people should be able to go to state colleges without going into, you know, debt penury for the rest of their lives. So when people get a chance, when they're offered the chance for genuinely radical ideas, they like them. They're popular.
It's interesting to hear you call them genuinely radical ideas because they are givens in most industrialized democracy. I mean, my question when people talk about the increasing currency of a word like socialism is does that go hand in hand with the meaning of the word just being somewhat diluted? Nobody's talking about social ownership of the means of production. They're talking about basic welfare state programs that you wouldn't even have a debate over in most of Western Europe.
Well, you know, since we're on a Pacific station, we can really get deep into it. I mean, I think the left has been a little bit disingenuous about fuzzing the line between socialism and social democracy. So, you know, I vote in Vermont, which means I vote Democratic, but I'm not a registered Democrat, just like Bernie Sanders, because we don't have party registration in Vermont. But I'm also a member of the British Labour Party. And on my British Labour Party card, it says the British Labour Party is a socialist democratic party, a democratic socialist party. So what does that mean? Does that mean that you have to own all the means of production? Well, ideally, at some point, it would be nice to see the workers own their enterprises, sure. But it as a transitional measure, as a first step, wouldn't it be great if, you know, if we had genuinely public schools? Wouldn't it be great if we owned the water companies, power companies, things that they have, for example, in incredibly radical blue states like Nebraska? Do you know that in Nebraska there's no private power? It's illegal. And that's because the populists put into place public power laws that were strong and that have lasted 100 years when they were first rising in 1890. So I think, yes, there is a certain amount of fuzzing between social democracy and genuine socialism. And of course, you know, genuine socialism, you can fight all day and people do, and tiny rooms in New York. I hope they're smarter than that.
They do it in Chicago too.
I hope they're smarter than that in California over, you know, which version of actually existing socialism was the worst and what went wrong with them all. I think, you know, I would put it this way. And that's one of the reasons there are historical chapters in the book too. You know, the person who said that labor precedes capital and that you can have labor without capital but no capital without labor wasn't Karl Marx, it was Abraham Lincoln. And he said that before Karl Marx had ever published anything. And when Marx published The Labor Theory of Value, he credited his theory to Benjamin Franklin. So these are Native American ideas that have deep roots on our soil. And I suppose my point is that we have our own vocabulary for them, and we don't need to get locked into, you know, European vocabularies that have been partially discredited by European tyrannies. I would prefer to say that what I'm in favor of, and what I see a majority of Americans are in favor of, if they're given the chance, is expanding the common sphere, expanding the number of things that we all own together. That doesn't mean we all have to own everything together. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're not allowed to have your own baseball bat, surfboard, bicycle. But it does mean that we should have more parks, we should have more zoos, that we should have more institutions that function like libraries. You know, when you walk into a library, there's no means testing. They don't say, oh, you're too rich, you can't come into this library, or you haven't worked enough, you can't borrow a book. We all own the library. You go to the library and you say, this is what I'm looking for. And the librarian says, it's over there. And that's the way more public institutions should work.
We're speaking to Don Guttenplan. His new book is The New Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority. He's giving a KPFA talk tonight at 7:30 p.m. at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue. Details on our website, kpfa.org. You have a great infatuation in this book with left-wing populism. Populism has a mixed history.
It does.
The way academics define it, it is almost always premised on the demonization of both elites and some kind of other. Frequently, that is immigrants or ethnic minorities in both its left and right wing versions.
Well, I would say it's interesting that you put it that way. I won't argue with the premise that most academics define it that way, but then most academics aren't populists. And, you know, I would say that populism always represents a revolt against an elite. That's true. And it's, if you look at Lawrence Goodwin's The Populist Moment, he calls it a great cultural achievement because, and this is one of the
things. Speaking about 19th century populism in America.
And this is because populists understood something that Andrew Breitbart understood, that Steve Bannon understood, but that Hillary Clinton never understood, and that most Democrats didn't understand, which is, and Breitbart said it this way. He said that politics is downstream of culture, that if you want to change things, you have to change the culture. And what we have in America is a culture of deference. If you're working class, you're told you're never good enough, you're never entitled to things, you should just take what you're given, you should do what you're told. And so the cultural achievement of populism is to say, no, we are entitled to more than this. We are entitled to run our own lives. We are entitled to have agency. And in that fight, I always know which side I'm on. But it's also true that what we had in 2016 was we had a door to the left that was barred shut. You know, there was you had Hillary Clinton saying, America's already great. And, you know, if you've seen your steel mill close in 1998, 1999, and there's been nothing but Mick Jobs in your town, which is true for much of Western Ohio, much of Eastern Ohio, much of Western Pennsylvania, much of West Virginia, lots of Michigan, and you're given the choice between somebody who says America's already great, things are fine, you can have four more years of what you've just had, and you should be happy, and someone who says no, things are bad, and they really need to change. And those are the two core messages that you're hearing. So the populism on the left, the door was barred. The populism on the right, the door was open and people went through it.
Well, if you go 6 months prior to Hillary Clinton saying America was already great, the door was not barred for the left. The Bernie Sanders campaign seemed to have the right message for the right moment in history, but he didn't get the nomination. So what's your diagnosis on why it worked in the Republican Party but not in the Democratic one?
Well, it's a good question. I suppose partly, you know, I'm not going to say that it was because Debbie Wasserman Schultz had her thumb on the scale, but of course the Democratic Party did have its thumbs on the scale. That's part of it. So in the same way that, you know...
But I think the Republican establishment was gunning for Donald Trump in much the same way.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I went to the first Republican debate. I went to the Republican National Committee summer meeting in Cleveland in September 2015, and that was the debate where they had the child's table and the grown-ups table, remember? And I wrote after that that there was nobody on that stage who was going to be able to stop Donald Trump. And that was the debate where they asked, you know, which of you will not promise to support the eventual Republican nominee? And Trump held up his hands. And I assumed at that point that the party organization would find some way to keep him off the ballot if he refused to pledge allegiance to the eventual nominee. But I think they realized this is the only this is the only guy we have who could actually win. And, you know, I didn't mostly spend my time with Republicans, but I checked in a lot. I went to Trump rallies in probably a half a dozen states. And each time I would go to somebody who I thought of as a sort of civilized establishment Republican, and I'd, you know, for example, right after the Access Hollywood tape, and I said to the guy who was the chair of the Republican Party in Ohio and a very nice man and somebody who was a trustee of the National Gallery, owned a nice art collection, you know, it's hard to call him a sort of total reactionary. And he said, well, Donald Trump will do 95, I'll disagree with 95% of the things he does, but I'll disagree with everything that Hillary Clinton will do, so I'll vote for Donald Trump. And, you know, that was the premise that you were going to peel off Republicans because Trump was a boor and a bigot and a sexist clearly didn't work.
Right.
But there is another part of it, too, and I think and that's the fact that we have – politics has not – until Trump, politics has not caught on to the fact that social capital is capital. That I covered Trump's first brushes with bankruptcy in New York in the 1980s for the Village Voice and New York Newsday. And he's never been as rich as he pretends to be. But what he had, and particularly going into the 2016 race, was this enormous celebrity, which he was allowed to weaponize and capitalize and draw on.
And specifically, according to New York Times reporting, manipulate stock prices to the benefit of his father.
Well, there you go. But what I mean is that he was able to use his celebrity as a form of political capital. And whether that means that in the future all politicians are going to have to be celebrities, or whether it means that politicians who are running against celebrities are going to have to find some new way to do it, I mean, that's a tough question.
Don Guttenplan's new book is The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority. He's speaking tonight at a KPFA benefit, 2727 College Avenue. That's St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley. As luck would have it, we have a pair of tickets to give away. Callers 5 and 10 will each win a pair. The phone number is 510-848-4425. That's 510-848-4425 to see Don Guttenplan speaking tonight, 7:30 at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley. So you talked about why Donald Trump was successful within the Republican primary. But the conversation kind of moved away from the question of why Bernie Sanders did not ultimately prevail. He currently clearly struck a chord with the American public that no one was expecting a socialist from Vermont to.
Including him, I think.
Including him. Yeah.
I think he wasn't ready for how well he was doing. I think that's part of it. And I think part of it is that things were slightly rigged against him. But I also think that he didn't run a particularly brilliant campaign. I mean, you know, he expected, for example, voters of color to rally to him simply because he'd been active in civil rights in the 1960s, which he genuinely did, and out of good motivation, and he did brave things. But he'd been representing Vermont I vote in Vermont.
It's whitest state in the union.
It's an incredibly white state. And he ought to have realized that, you know, coming from Vermont, you have to make an extra effort. You have to go an extra mile, and you have to listen to people. And also, and I think, again, it's not clear to me even now whether his campaign was really meant as a campaign to win the nomination or as a protest movement. Because if you're really running to win the nomination, and you're trying, and you realize that the Democratic Party's base is largely people of color, then you have to put in the time. You know, you have to show up. I mean, I remember talking to Kevin Alexander Gray, who's a political activist in South Carolina, about who showed up for Jesse Jackson's mother's funeral. And, you know, the Clintons were there, and, you know, all these other people were there. But Bernie Sanders didn't have anybody there because he didn't think, oh, this isn't the place I need to be. You have to put in the time with people. And even if your ideas are great, you know, for very good historical reasons, African American voters are the most clued up, the most skeptical voters, particularly in the South, because they've seen people come and go. They've seen white liberals come and go. They've been promised all sorts of things. You know, somebody said to Chakwe Antar Lumumba, "What did you feel about the election of Donald Trump? You know, how did that change you? How did that change things for you?" And he said, "You know, the morning before Donald Trump was elected, I woke up in Mississippi. The morning after he was elected, I was still in Mississippi. We're at the bottom regardless." So, you know, you have to put in time. You have to listen to people. You have to demonstrate that you're for real.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because a lot of what you profile in the book is people organizing in very adverse circumstances. One would not necessarily expect Jackson, Mississippi to be a hotbed of radically revisioning society. What did you come across in the work of Chokwe Antar Lumumba?
Well, he really interested me for a couple of reasons. One is because... you know, during Obama, we had this hallucination. It was a widely held hallucination. I don't think I ever fully succumbed to it, but I'm sure I came close, that we were in this post-racial society where we were all going to stand around and sing Kumbaya around the campfire. And
that was kind of the vision he campaigned on. We're not a red America, a blue America. We're the United States of America.
That's right.
He vote for me and we can get over this all.
He campaigned on it, and, you know, and Bill Clinton partly campaigned on it too. You know, Bill Clinton, our first African American president, said Maya Angelou. So, you know, there was a view that we didn't really need to pay attention to race anymore. And I guess I grew up in Tennessee, in Memphis, and so I never fully bought that. But I also knew that the hardest place in the country is on race. It's always going to be Mississippi. You know, I really hope that Stacey Abrams wins her race to be governor of Georgia. She'd make a fantastic governor of Georgia, and she has a real chance. And the fact that she even has a real chance shows that things have changed in Georgia quite a lot. But when I heard about that, that to me said that I don't need to go to Georgia. I need to go to Mississippi because things haven't changed that much in Mississippi. So I came across Antar Lumumba at the People's Summit, which was a kind of post-Bernie gathering in Chicago, where he stood up and he said he wanted to make Jackson the most radical city in the country. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And then I looked into his background. His father, Chakwe Lumumba Sr., had been mayor of Jackson and then died after 4 months in office. And the father had been the vice president of the Republic of New Africa, so a nationalist separatist group. And again, if you look like me, if you're a middle-aged white liberal, you are taught all the time that cultural nationalism is a dead end, that black separatism was a dangerous distraction from the kind of integrationist politics that are the only thing that are ever going to make real progress in this country. And it's part of a rap that's quite convenient for people like me, which is that if we would just stop going on about race and gender and we could focus on class all the time, that then we could have this genuinely class-based movement that would bring about, you know, the triumph.
Can't use that word on the air.
Sorry. I've always thought that was baloney. Sorry. And so I wanted to go to Mississippi. I wanted to see what was happening with someone who came out of a background that was supposed to be, you know, a total waste of time, and who had come to a place where what he was agitating for was exactly what I had said before, expanding the common space, expanding the commons. So they're taking vacant lots, as in your previous, you know, discussion, they're taking vacant lots in Jackson and they're turning them into community gardens. They're taking abandoned buildings and they're turning them over to community enterprises. They are trying to develop an economy where people can prosper without being pushed out by gentrification, as they do in so many other cities. So they are trying to to develop a genuine socially based economy in Jackson. And they're doing it under the most adverse conditions possible in the face of a Tea Party Republican governor and a Republican lock state legislature that is trying to cut the legs off them every step they take.
So what's the power building strategy there?
The power building strategy there is to be clear on who they are, be clear on what they want, and also pay attention to the nuts and bolts. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is when you talk to Chakwe Lumumba, he talks about a vision for a cooperative economy. He talks about how he wants to make Jackson the kind of Mondragon on the Mississippi. But he also talks about potholes and how if he doesn't do something about potholes when he's mayor, he's not going to get a second term. Because they're the sort of systematic disinvestment in Jackson, which is the state capital of Mississippi, by the way. So it means that the state legislators, like it or not, have to spend some time there. But there are still potholes big enough to swallow a small car. And he realizes he's got to do something about that. He's got to do something about the fact that all of the entertainment chains that own movie theaters have moved to the white suburbs. So there isn't a single movie theater, you know, in Jackson, a city of 170,000 people.
All right. Don Guttenplan, we'll leave the conversation there and leave it to be continued tonight on the KPFA stage. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's been great to be here.
Don Guttenplan's brand new book is The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority. It's based on 2 years of field reporting across the United States of America, chronicling the figures, the organizations, and the movements that he thinks are the basis for a new left resurgency in this country. The event is tonight, 7:30 p.m. at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley. That's 2727 College Avenue. Tickets available over the counter at local independent booksellers, over the internet at brownpapertickets.com. And if I spoke too fast for you, you can look up the full details at our website, kpfa.org.